BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to Dialect Radio. Hello and welcome to the 2nd of February edition of Dialect Radio, coming to you every Saturday lunchtime from the Headley Radio Studio at Bristol Empire and Commonwealth Museum at Brunel's original Temple Meads Railway Station in Bristol. Coming up today, it's a political sketch of Bristol City Council as we meet the leader of the opposition. Also, Benazir Bhutto and the remarkable interview she gave to David Frost just days before she was assassinated. Plus, we have the regular poetry slot, an interview with Eileen Clark, who's had lunch with the Queen, and a couple of songs from Calvin Smith, and of course, Jeff Sparks' What's On guide. On the Museum Archive slot, we have a listen back to wartime Pakistan. Now over to John Peters Coleman with the news.
The Bristol Old Vic Theatre, which until recently has been facing a gloomy future, has just had just over £500,000 of funds earmarked for the next year, courtesy of the Arts Council South West. In December, they stated that they could not, at that time, renew funding for a further 3 years. In a recent statement, they now state, "Since December, there have been dramatic and important developments. Bristol Old Vic has responded to our initial concerns with an energetic and practical explanation of how it intends to regain its former preeminence as one of the country's most important producing companies. We have also been impressed by the overwhelming support given to Dick Penny by theatre practitioners, funding stakeholders and members of the public. As a result, we believe that we can see the first green shoots of a potentially exciting recovery, one that deserves our support. There is still a lot of work to do and Bristol Old Vic needs the time to firm up its plans. We have told Bristol Old Vic that half of the funds earmarked for the next year, £578,000, is now available to help them with this work. If, as we hope, progress continues to be made, the remaining funds will follow. We have also confirmed that we will continue to reserve capital funds for the refurbishment of the theatre hall and look forward to receiving detailed plans in due course." Dick Penny, who has recently accepted the offer to join the board as executive chair, has also stated that their intention is to take a phased approach so that they can reopen the theatre to the public as soon as possible. The target for studio reopening is spring 2009, with the Theatre Royal to follow in late 2009 or early 2010. Throughout the reconstruction process, they will be hosting regular open events, the youth theatre will continue to operate, and up-to-date news and comment will be posted on the website. Avon and Somerset Police is to privatise key sections of its civilian workforce, the first move of its kind in Britain. No other police force in the country has gone to such lengths. Although the police authority has yet to formally sign a contract, its members last night effectively gave the go-ahead for computer giant IBM to run a number of its key departments. Concerns have been raised because US firm IBM cooperated closely with Hitler's SS and Gestapo in the 1930s in helping catalogue Jews, disabled people and other, quote, undesirables, unquote. Although the details have not yet been released, it is thought the deal will mean that the force's finance, IT and human resources department will all be privatised. Following 15 months of intense negotiations, the force will join Somerset County Council and Taunton Deane Borough Council. Both councils have already signed up to the £400 million partnership. The two councils signed a deal with IBM last year to set up a private company called Southwest One to run a number of departments including human resources, IT and finance. It is understood that the deal will affect about 600 backroom civilian police employees whose jobs will now transfer to the new firm. The deal will be rubber-stamped before the end of March and comes after the Bristol Evening Post revealed this week that the government is short-changing Avon and Somerset Police by almost £60 million, which is likely to lead to a substantial council tax increase in April. The British Empire and Commonwealth Museum is in line for a top arts prize. Its Breaking the Chains exhibition, created to mark the bicentenary of the abolition of the slave trade, is in the running for the top honour. The museum is one of 10 museums and galleries being considered for the Art Fund Prize, formerly the Gulbenkian Prize. The coveted prize, won 2 years ago by the SS Great Britain, is worth £100,000. It is awarded to the museum or gallery whose project demonstrates the most originality, imagination and excellence. Last year, the Empire and Commonwealth Museum announced plans to leave Bristol and seek a new home in London. It is up against Liverpool's International Slavery Museum, opened in 2000, which uses the story of the transatlantic slave trade to explore issues such as freedom, identity, human rights, racism and cultural exchange. Also on the list of contenders are the British Library in London for an exhibition which brought together the world's greatest collection of Jewish, Christian and Islamic holy texts. The London Transport Museum and National Army Museum in London are on the list for an exhibition created by soldiers which explores the British Army's first campaign in Afghanistan's Taliban heartland, Helmand Province. This is the first year that the Art Fund, one of the UK's largest independent art charities, has sponsored this major arts prize, which is open to all museums and galleries in the UK. Sue McGregor, head of the judging panel, said, "We're going to have an exciting and absorbing time visiting all 10 museums and galleries. There are two different exhibitions to consider on the history of the slave trade, one in Liverpool and one in Bristol. Eventually, 10 must be whittled down to one, but I know we've been bowled over by the imagination and inspiration we've encountered on the way." Anne Lanine, exhibition manager for Breaking the Chain, said, "Obviously, we are delighted to be in the running for this award. A team of about a dozen people worked very hard on this exhibition, and everybody put a lot into it. It was a demanding and emotional experience, and to have some recognition is really gratifying." Following judges' visits, four museums and galleries will be shortlisted and announced in early April. The winner will be announced on May the 22nd at the Royal Institute of British Architects in London during Museum and Galleries Month 2008. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez last week urged his allies to form an anti-imperialist military alliance to defend Latin America from potential attack by the United States. Speaking on his weekly TV program, Alo Presidente, he called upon Bolivia, Cuba and Nicaragua to unite with Venezuela and work to form a joint defense strategy and start joining our armed forces, armed navies, national guards and intelligence forces. "Because the enemy is the same, the empire, anyone who messes with one of us will have to mess with all of us because we will all respond as one." Chavez again reiterated claims that neighbouring Colombia is preparing a military provocation against his country. "We are sure the Colombian government is following the line that Washington dictates," Chavez said. Nicaragua's president, Daniel Ortega, who accompanied Chavez on the programme, added that US officials are using Colombia as a strategic pawn in an effort to counter regional integration initiatives championed by Chavez. "This isn't just against Venezuela, it's against the integration process," said Ortega, who was in Caracas for the summit meeting of the Chavez-led Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas.
The disaster of Benazir Bhutto's assassination for Pakistan and democracy is already fading in our minds. But as the weeks have rolled by since she was shot in December, so more information has emerged about who might have killed her. In one particular recording of Benazir, she names those she believed wanted her dead. She arrived in Pakistan on the 18th of October 2007 to begin election campaigning. On the same day, a bomb next to her convoy killed about 150 people and injured nearly 500. Benazir survived the attack and was invited 2 weeks later onto David Frost's Frost Over the World programme on Al Jazeera on the 2nd of November. There she named those she thought were responsible for the first assassination attempt. Not President Musharraf himself, but members of his senior intelligence staff. Here is an extract.
"Yes, it is true that I wrote to General Musharraf. I received information from General Musharraf that a friendly country had passed on to them the information that I could be attacked by a gang from the Afghan warlord Baitullah Masood or by Hamza bin Laden, the son of Osama bin Laden, or by the Pakistani Taliban in Islamabad, or by a group in Karachi. So I sent back a letter saying that while these groups may be used, I thought it was more important to go after the people who supported them, who organized them, who could possibly be the financiers or the organizers of the finance for those groups. And I named three individuals who I thought were their sympathizers. Now I understand that I could be wrong and my suspicions could be misplaced. But these are the people that I suspect want to stop the restoration of democracy. They want to stop my return because they know in 1993, when Pakistan was on the brink of being declared a terrorist state, I stopped the rise of terrorism, and they know that I can do it again. So I feel that these are the forces that really want to stop not just me, but the democratic process and the will of the people from triumphing."
And in terms of these three people that you mentioned, were they members of or associated with the government?
Yes, well, one of them is a very key figure in security. He's a former military officer. He's someone that has had dealings with Jaish-e-Mohammed, one of the banned groups, with Maulana Azhar, who was in an Indian jail for decapitating three British tourists and three American tourists. And he also had dealings with Umar Sheikh, the man who murdered Osama bin Laden. Now, I know that having dealings with people does not necessarily mean direct evidence, but I also know that internal security has totally collapsed in Pakistan, and that internal security cannot collapse without there being some blind eye, if not collusion, being turned to the rise of the militants and militancy. Not only are our tribal areas out of our control, but even the beautiful valley of Swat is now under takeover by Islamists. So I would like to see a Park-led police inquiry assisted by Scotland Yard or the FBI come in, use their forensic and scientific explanation to find out not only the perpetrators, but the financiers and the organizers of this heinous crime that killed 158 innocent people.
Benazir Bhutto there, recorded on the 2nd November 2007, naming three suspects as probably being behind the financing and organising of her assassination. Chaudhry Pervez Elahi, a rival politician and chief minister of Pakistan's Punjab province, Hamid Goel, former director of the Inter-Services Intelligence, and Ijaz Shah, the director general of the Intelligence Bureau, another of the country's intelligence agencies. You can hear the full 20-minute interview on radioforall.net.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And now here's a song from my very good friend Dominic Bennyworth, who's coming over from Spain. Kylie, Confide in Me.
Thank you.
Confide in me. At the moment, Bristol City Council is under no overall control, and that means that one party has a majority of councillors, so two of the three main parties have to form a coalition in order to lead the council. Steve Coomer is the leader of the Liberal group on Bristol City Council. Hi, Steve, in your wonderful Bristol Rovers football attire. Welcome to Daleks.
Yes.
How did you come to have usually oppositional parties, like the Labour and Tory parties, forming an alliance against you?
It often happens that you get strange alliances. The makeup of Bristol, 31 Liberal Democrats, 25 Labour, 13 Tories and 1 Green. What's actually happened is that there's not a coalition as such, but the Labour group have decided to, the Conservative group have decided to support a Labour administration this year. They've got their own political reasons. They obviously think in some ways that will be to their advantage, I imagine. But, that's the way the arithmetic goes, and that's the way the results came out. So it can happen that way.
I mean, there have been many talks over the years of, on a national level, Liberals trying to do an alliance with Labour. Do you feel that that would ever happen? Do you think that would help at all? Would you be able to do that?
I think in all of this, it depends what policies you're hoping to put forward. If you can get an agreement on a programme for government, whether that's at national or local level, then clearly that can happen. And certainly that did happen in Scotland for about 8 years, and now that alliance is no longer. So I think it very much depends on where your political priorities are at the time, and whether enough of those coincide in order to make a working arrangement possible. In Bristol, that hasn't been possible. We had minority Liberal Democrat administration for 2 years. We've now got a minority Labour administration. What happens this May at the annual meeting? I don't know.
Right. Does the Liberal Party hold cabinet posts, or just Labour and Conservative?
No, it's just Labour hold the cabinet posts. So it's a single party cabinet. We held the cabinet posts for 2 years, and now Labour does. As I say, we're not that enamoured with the cabinet system, but it was imposed on us by central government.
Right. How does that work?
Well, essentially, it's similar to the Westminster model, where you have a number of councillors who have responsibility for particular programme areas like transport or housing or education or whatever, and the rest of the council is engaged with what's called scrutiny, which is when you actually look at what's happening. But scrutiny can only delay things. So you have less people involved in direct decision making than under former arrangements.
Right. So does that mean developing an elite developing in each party, if you like?
Well, I think it does, inevitably, yes. You have that divide, and there are people who are good local ward councillors, but because of work and other commitments, don't have the time that you need to be a cabinet member. And I think that is a problem, and that's reducing the pool of talent and not increasing it.
Right, so how come this such a wide divergence, obviously, between Labour and Liberal that stops an alliance forming? What are the differences that keep you apart?
I think the main differences in the Bristol context are that we're very much the party that wants to make changes and improve the services and improve the way Bristol runs. I think Labour, because it's governed Bristol, and we mustn't forget this, it governed Bristol from 1972 right the way through to 1983 with only a year's break. They tend to be pretty establishment, cautious and slow at making changes. And I think Bristol is a very dynamic and vibrant city, and the City Council needs to reflect that and actually change the way it operates so that it's more people focused and doesn't just have this idea that, you know, we're a venerable old institution and we know best. And I think Labour does come from that ethos.
What are your views on transport and on the performance of First Bus in particular?
I think First Bus is a real problem. Bus deregulation has been an absolute disaster for cities like Bristol. And I think what we're seeing now after 20 years is the after effects of that. First, operate on a basis where they have to make profits in localities where they operate. And that's the reason why we have this combination of high fares and poor service.
I mean, what can be done about that? What are your policies? What do you propose to be done?
We've supported setting up a strategic transport authority for the greater Bristol area, so that will include areas around like South Gloucestershire and Bath and so on. And I think if you had that, you'd be in a stronger position to commission services and regulate operators. At the moment, we don't have that, and each council sort of does a little bit of subsidy for buses on late night and early morning services, for example, and on uneconomic routes. I think this would enable us to be far more strategic across the piece, and it's... I think it's a reason why some other cities are ahead of the game when they've got this sort of structure.
Buses run by the council used to make money.
Well, I don't think it's about making money or who runs the services. It's about making a service that people will use. And I think what we've seen in some other cities is that they've had the investment from central government in order to... bring transport improvements in. I mean, I've been to places like Nottingham and Liverpool, and you see much, much better transport infrastructure. So whoever's running it, we are starting from where we are, and I don't think we're going to be able to change the whole structure of transport, but it does need regulating, and it does need to make sure that we can deliver a service. And I'm convinced from what I've seen in other cities that if you deliver a good service, then you will get people to use it.
Hmm. How do you think the current administration... is faring on drugs and prostitution in Bristol, and what do you think should be done?
I think in terms of drugs, obviously most of what is done through other agencies, and I'm very pleased that at long last the underfunding that Bristol's had from national agencies is coming to an end, and we see the Bristol Drugs Project, which is a tremendous organisation with an excellent reputation, is finally getting more resources coming in, and we're getting the level of funding equivalent to that of other cities. As far as prostitution is concerned, I don't think we're moving fast enough. I represent an area that includes Fishponds Road, which has a major problem with street prostitution, and I think we've got to be bold and radical and look at means of moving this trade away from residential areas. And I think it's a question of acceptance that it will continue to happen, but to provide means to help women who want to get out of the trade, and give them better safety as well. So I would like to see managed displacement away from residential areas and better support for people involved in the sex industry.
Right. I mean, there has been talks about having licensed brothels. Where do you stand on that from a liberal perspective?
I think that's an idea worth looking at. It has succeeded in other countries, and I think there is some merit in having a system where you can get access. I mean, in Bristol, we've not had the problem with trafficked women that other cities have had yet. Mm. But one of the problems they have is, you know, you hear horrendous stories of people being beaten up and their passports being withheld and so on. And they're working from premises, and the police actually have no right of access. Now, if you have licensed premises, then that automatically gives you a right of access. Licenses can be revoked, and I can see merits in terms of personal safety for those in the industry for moving in that direction. So I think this is an idea worth looking at.
Right. I mean, all of these sort of take money, really, and we hear that council tax is going to be going up again while baths, parks and libraries are closing. So what do you think about the city's finances at the moment? Do they look pretty poor?
They're not brilliant. Could always be better. Where we are at the moment, I think Labour are sticking to the financial plan that the Liberal Democrat cabinet had, which is a council tax of around the rise of around the 4% level. Mm. The money from government in terms of grant is lower than that, and so we have this increasing gap where central government is forcing more and more onto the council tax. I'd like to see a much more radical shift in terms of taxation so that more decisions can be made locally. And at the moment, we're far too centralised as a political culture. We have the most centralised political culture of any country in the European Union, with the exception of Malta. Without wishing to be insulting to Malta, I mean, it is only in population terms equivalent to Bristol and the surrounding areas. So, and it's fairly small geographically. So I think we do need this sort of move, and that would enable local people, I think, to feel that they're making more decisions about spending locally. At the moment, most of the decisions are in fact made in Whitehall.
Right. I mean, does that account for the one thing I hear quite a lot about the Liberal Democrats, in that there is quite a wide discrepancy between the national agenda and the local agenda? I mean, do you think that some people suggest that that leads the Liberal Democrats to seem a little bit disconnected sometimes? Do you think that would be an issue if you're promoting localisation?
I don't think so. I think actually, you know, all our MPs I speak to are very keen on this agenda. I think we very much want to move in that direction. It's very much central to our whole philosophy that power should be exercised at the lowest level possible. There's some things you have to do at a national level. There's some things you have to do at a European or a United Nations level. But I think what's happened in the UK is too much has got sucked up into the centre. And, you know, we need to make sure that it comes back. I mean, we used to be in that position. Major cities in the 19th century, you know, ran gasworks and ran water and so on and did a lot of things. So, and European cities still do. So I don't see there's any problem with making that shift.
Right. What do you feel about the local press? And because they are sort of a link between the general public and what they know about local politics. And do you think they serve the local community well enough?
I think the local press has a problem in that over 20 to 30 years they've got a steadily declining circulation, and a lot of that is demographic, with more and more people switching to things like internet communication and so on. But I do find at times that they almost veer on the opposition for the sake of it. It's almost as if sometimes, you know, the paper's not complete without pictures of half a dozen residents looking grumpy in different places. And I think that's a bit of a shame.
Yeah.
I'd like to see them be a bit more upbeat and to actually talk up Bristol, because, you know, I mean, council aside, this is a wonderful city. There's a lot going for it. You know, economically we're prosperous. We've got tremendous cultural scene. And, you know, I'd like to see a bit more of that, and occasionally we get a little bit too much of the negative. I'm a bit biased. I mean, I am a Bristolian who chose to move back to the city, and perhaps I see the glasses half full rather than half empty a bit more than some.
Okay, I mean, are you attempting to foster more interaction with general public online?
Yes, very much so. City Council's done a lot on that. We've got a lot of meetings webcast now. And it's quite interesting, the reaction of councillors. Initially, a lot thought, oh, webcasting, not sure about this. And now I find that in a couple of meetings, colleagues of mine on the Liberal Democrat side have said, we've got a call in on a home care proposal on Friday, and my colleagues were saying, oh, we must have this webcast. There's a lot of public interest in this.
Yeah.
We must let people see what's going on. So I think online petitions have been very successful. I think there's a lot more that can be done, but I think we're actually ahead of a lot of cities in terms of using online communication, and that has to be the way of the future.
Okay, yeah. What's the main problem your Eastville constituents contact you about at the moment?
A number of issues, really. Street prostitution, I've already mentioned.
Mm.
Traffic congestion is a problem everywhere. We've got places like Muller Road and Fishponds Road in the ward, which are always a problem, and parts of Stapleton as well suffer from that. Other than that, planning issues loom quite large. There's always pressure on space, and so that that can be a major factor. Obviously, the ward contains Eastville Park, so a lot of people are concerned about the park and want better investment and supervision in the park. So I think those are the main sorts of things that come up most often. But you do get a range of things come up. I mean, your previous item was about Pakistan, and I've recently had a family contact me because their daughter went out there for a family funeral and couldn't get back into the country. So I think we've resolved that one. But, you know, it's many and varied what comes your way.
Right. Are there unelected groups such as businessmen in Bristol, lastly, that sort of influence decision-making as well as politicians?
I think there's lots of groups that influence decision making. I mean, obviously, business has economic clout, but equally, you've got voluntary organisations, you've got community groups, and so on, and they all have an influence in what happens. Yes.
All right. Well, what's your vision for the city? What's sort of best case scenario for the near future? What are you hoping for?
I think for the near future, I'd like us to stay economically prosperous with a low level of unemployment. But I do think we need to tackle the pockets of poverty that we have in our midst. And I would like to see jobs go into some of the areas that need them. I'd like us to be a much more sustainable city, to make progress on transport. And finally, if we don't tackle the housing crisis in the city, then we'll go into decline. So I think we've got a lot of housing coming into the city, and we've got to make sure that a high proportion of that is affordable at the different levels of affordability, but specifically to rent or on shared ownership.
All right. Well, Steve, Councillor Steve Comer, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Opposition Liberal Group leader there and member for Eastville. You can contact Steve on 0117 902 2204. Home numbers for all city councillors, but not even names of senior council officers, are available on the web at www.bristol.gov.uk.
Wake up to yesterday on BCFM. Midnight to midday, we repeat all the programmes so you can catch up on all the ones you've missed or just enjoy them again. BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
On this week's Empire and Commonwealth Museum archive, we go over to Pakistan and hear from a man with Scottish colonial roots who grew up in Pakistan just before the war, Wilfred Stringer.
Well, my father was born in Nagpur, and my mother was born in Alwar, but the first thing was from my mother's side being Scottish, I said.
Oh, yes, of course, yes.
My mother being Scottish and my dad being a real Anglo-Indian, my father being real Anglo-Indian, and they just got married and that was it. I said, and my father married my mother, and there were four children, and when you look back, my father was married about well over 30 years.
And you don't know, did you meet your paternal grandfather, your father's father?
Yes, yeah. I did meet him, yeah.
And he was a railway man, too. Was he your...
Yeah, no, his name was Tom Stringer. He was in the military at that time, but I don't know what part of the military was, whether he was in the infantry or whether he was in a unit and all that, but I know he was in the army, because I see the photographs and I used to say, Dad, who is this? He says, oh, this is your granddad, he says. And his name was Tom Stringer.
Had he come out in the British Army?
Yeah, in the British Army, yeah.
So
yeah.
Was he what you'd call a Tommy, ex-Tommy?
Ex-Tommy, yeah, ex-Tommy. And then what happened was... my father sent me to a school called Franklin's College there. I did my junior Cambridge, I did my senior Cambridge. But when I got out in the world, my father wanted me to join the Navy. So I went all the way to Bombay to
this
get...
This would have been about when, Wilfred?
This is...
roughly.
Little before the partition, 1939. So we went up to Bombay and we stayed in the retiring rooms at Victoria.
That was the railway retirement
room. Yeah,
rooms,
railway. It was called, railway retirement room, and the railway was called the GIP, the Great Indian Peninsula Railway. And I had to get on the job at the HMS Dufferin ship. Anyway, I didn't pass the test because I knew nothing about naval procedure and all that. And my father got very angry and got upset and came all the way back, and he said, the best thing is I'm going to put you in the army. So... he came and he sent me to Rawalpindi, and when I went to Rawalpindi, I was taken in the army in the ROC, Royal Army Ordnance Corps.
At what rank? As a craftsman.
Wilfred Stringer there, who grew up in Pakistan just before the war. This week's Empire and Commonwealth Museum audio archive.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
In the studio today is our special guest, Eileen Clark. Welcome, Eileen. Eileen has been living in Bristol for 3 years and is here today to tell us about her lunch with none other than the Queen herself.
Thank you, Lisa. Nice to be here. 1990 was a memorable year for me in many ways. I had the fortune to do vacation work at Portland Training College. Portland Training College is a college that was given over to the education of physically handicapped adults. And it happened to be that in 1990 was their 40th anniversary. And the Queen was invited to attend the celebrations. And I was fortunate enough to be selected to be part of the reception group who met the Queen, had lunch with the Queen, and it was a bit of a do. It was very enjoyable.
Were you nervous at all about meeting her, or were you quite sort of ambivalent about it?
No, I wasn't nervous. I was excited. It was quite a remarkable occasion. I think what was even more remarkable was the fact that we had to give our names for the protection squad, and we had spangles going all the way down alleys and down the drains, and we were told how to behave and what not to do and what not to say, and such as if the Queen acknowledged us, we couldn't put our hand out to her. She had to put her hand out to us first. The food was quite spectacular, and I wore a red hat.
A red hat.
A red hat. That looked quite remarkable. And it was a bit of a do.
You brought some memorabilia with you today, which obviously our listeners can't see, but could you just sort of go through what you brought with you?
Yes, it was... the Queen signed the special address book that they had. Because Portland Training College does remarkable work for physically handicapped adults. The Queen presented the prizes to the students. They were involved with all, went walkabout with all the students, and there were photographs of her arriving with her lady-in-waiting. Prince Philip was there with his equerry. When the lunch had finished and we were all in a circle, the Queen went one side, Prince Philip went the other, with the Royal Protection Squad in the middle, and sort of talked and nodded, and we nodded and bowed, and it was... It was an occasion. It was something that remained within my memory for a long time. And it was enjoyable. But 1990 was also the year that my granddaughter was born.
A memorable year.
And my granddaughter is now 18 years old this year. So, as I said, 1990 was a very much a memorable year.
Going back to your luncheon, could you describe the Queen's table manners, and could you also tell me, are you actually a royalist?
Well, I sat very near to her, sort of from one side of the room to the other, and I remember looking at her, and she sort of nibbled a little bit.
She nibbled? And she's a nibbler. Okay.
She didn't really eat very much, not as far as I could be aware. As for being a royalist, I think the Queen, it is important that we have a royal family. As for a royalist, that's another question for another day.
Very diplomatically put there, Eileen.
Yes.
How many of the were you sat at the table? How many of them were you?
Oh, I think there'd be about 50 of us. It was quite a large informal gathering.
I wouldn't have liked to be in the kitchen that day cooking.
No. It was very nice. It was quite something. As I said, it was a memory that I will keep with me.
What was the most memorable thing for you? The thing that will stay with you?
Oh, yes. When there were three sections to it, we had the formal do, when the Queen was announced with a fanfare, and we all sat. And then she came into the room, and she was this very small, very dour personality, didn't smile. And I thought, my word. And then all of a sudden, she smiled, and the room lit up. It was just as if sunlight. Now, that, for me, was the most remarkable. Here, as you can see on this photograph, I know your listeners can't see, but she smiled, and it was like sunlight. Now, that, for me, was truly remarkable.
So she was very radiant?
Yes. She put everyone at ease. It wasn't as if, you know, no one was nervous, because she had this ability to make everyone feel at ease and feel comfortable.
I understand you were given a gift prior to leaving.
Yes, I had a little sort of wine glass which with an inscription on it, so that's something I will keep along with the photographs and the bits and pieces, because I'm a great one for keeping memories. I think it's important we all keep our memories.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming in today, Eileen. Thank you. Eileen Clark there, regaling us with her memories of meeting the Queen Elizabeth in 1990.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Some of the new jingles are here today. In the studio right now, we've got Calvin Smith, who's going to sing some songs for us here in the studio. Hi, Calvin.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. You have appeared on Broadway, and not only that, you were one of the first artists to feature on our shows from the British Empire and Commonwealth Museum radio studio.
Terrific.
An honour. What are you going to sing for us today?
I'm going to sing something from the theatre, and then since Valentine's is right around the corner, I want to sing a song for the lovers in our audience today.
Wonderful.
I'm sure there are a few. But this is for those who love the theater. Old Man River, that old man river, he must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling. He keeps on rolling along. He don't plant taters. He don't plant cotton. But them that's lost him is soon forgotten. But old man River, he just keeps rolling along. You and me, we sweat and strain, bodies all aching and racked with pain. Tow that barge and lift that bale. You get a little drunk and you land in jail. Gets weary and sick of trying. I'm tired of living, but scared of dying. And oh, man river, he just keeps rolling along.
Good audience.
Well, what are you up to right now these days? Are you on Broadway at the moment?
Actually, I'm going to give a concert in Bristol in the next few weeks. So listen to this station to find out.
To find out more. Stay tuned.
It's going to be a big concert. I gave one in Phelan recently, and I didn't know anybody, and there were 400 people there. Yeah. I think what it speaks of is the bio that they saw of the shows that I've been fortunate enough to be a part of, and the music that I was doing. So even though they didn't know me, 400 people showed up. I'm like, who are all these people? I thought I needed to build a fan base. But I think it was because of this genre of music is so hoped for, and if you can do it, they'll give you a chance.
Where are you performing your concerts?
And I'm
so sad as I was talking to Anthea earlier. I can't remember the name of the church. It begins with an R, but it's not Redcliffe. It's written on my desk, and so I will be back in touch with you, and we'll be able to let your listeners know, and I would love for you all to come. But I'm sorry that I've left home this morning without my little piece of paper telling me the name of the church where the concert will take place. But we will
find out.
We will announce it to the people.
And advertise. About sort of the British Old Vic, which is obviously a topic of conversation here most weeks. I mean, what do you think about the state of theatre in Bristol at the moment?
Well, I think that from what I've heard in the past few days, that monies may arrive to help to refurbish the Grand Old Vic, which is good news. I just think that the people of Bristol and the west of England need to protect your cultural treasures. You know, I mean, don't sell any of them off. Don't let any of them leave town. But you need to fight for future generations so that these things can be here. The Old Vic, you know, everything needs preserving. The SS Great Britain, and, you know, if you lose them, they're gone.
So. Yeah, because I noticed you said the southwest, because the Northcote Theatre is in Exeter is in trouble as well. So I think it is a sort of a southwest thing. But let's hope for the future.
Yeah.
What are you going to perform for your next song?
Ah, it's Valentine's. It turned February yesterday, so yeah. I'm in the mood.
Right.
I would like to dedicate this to all of the lovers who are out there and those special people who are thinking about a special someone else.
Take it away.
I tell them that you care for them. And this song was written by Richard Rodgers and Lawrence Hart. Irvin Berlin once said of Richard Rodgers and Lawrence Hart, my favorite composers, he said, tuneful and tasty, schmaltzy and smart, music by Rodgers, lyrics by Hart. So this is for the lovers out there. You're my funny Valentine. Sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Your looks are laughable, unphotographable, yet you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak? When you open it to speak, are you smart? But don't change a hair for me. Not if you care for me. Stay, little Valentine. Stay. Each day is Valentine's Day. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak? When you open it to speak, are you smart? But don't change a hair for me. Not if you care for me. Stay, little Valentine. Stay. Each day is Valentine's Day.
Thank you very much.
Happy Valentine.
Thank you.
BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio. Radio.
And now it's over for that weekly slot, Jeff's What's On Guide.
Thank you, Lisa. Good afternoon. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Kicking things off with Friday, 8th of February, at the Fleece and Firkin in Bristol, the Clash tribute group London Calling will be performing with support from the She Creatures. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance. Also on Friday night and at the Mayor's Arms in Clarence Road, Redcliffe in Bristol, it's the weekly High Notes Showcase Night. Performing on the night will be Anna Young, Shaiko and Andrew Beasley. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and this week the honours go to Fats Domino. This is from the album His Greatest Hits, and it's a track titled Jambalaya on the Bio.
Goodbye, Joe. Me gotta go. Me on my own. Me gotta go. Pull the piano down the bio. My boy, sweet boy. Me on my own. Son of a gun, we'll have big fun on the bio. Jambalaya, coffee pie, feeling gumbo. Cause tonight I'm gonna see my machete meal. The guitar, the good joy in the gale. Son of a gun, we have big fun on the bio.
Fats Domino with Jambalaya on the Bio. It is worth noting that he'll be celebrating his 80th birthday this year on February 26th. For more information, you can check out www.fatsdominoonline.com. Moving on to Saturday, 9th of February, and what has to be one of the highlights of 2008 so far is the reformation of local punk legends Herb Garden. Now, this event will be happening at the Polish Club in St. Paul's Road in Clifton, Bristol. And to gain access to this event, you need to go to myspace.com/herbgardeninfo and contact the band for an invite, as this is an invite-only event. Finally, on Sunday, 10th of February, at the Seven Stars, which is next door to the Feast in Firkin, there is an acoustic afternoon hosted by Alfie Kingston and featuring four local performers. This will start at 3 p.m. and entry is, of course, free. That is all from me today. Thank you for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks very much there, Jeff. This week's poems are American and read by Dialect's Kristin Powers from Denver in Colorado. The first poem is called American Names and was written by Stephen Vincent Bennett, who was born in 1898 in the steel town of Bethlehem in Pennsylvania. His best-known piece was John Brown's Body, an American epic covering the Civil War from the view of a widely contrasting protagonist. The second poem, The Garden, was written by eccentric Ezra Pound, who lived in London and became part of the literary circle which met at Harold Monroe's shop in Museum Street. He arrived in London in 1909 but left in 1920 for Paris because he felt London had become too sterile.
I have fallen in love with American names, the sharp names that never get fat, the snakeskin titles of mining claims, the plumed war bonnet of Medicine Hat, Tucson and Deadwood and Lost Mule Flat. Sen and Piav are silver spoons, but the spoon bowl metal is thin and worn. There are English counties like hunting tunes played on the keys of a postboy's horn, but I will remember where I was born. I will remember Carquinez Straits, Little French Lick, and Lundy's Lane. The Yankee ships and the Yankee dates and the bullet towns of Calamity Jane. I will remember Skunktown Plain. I will fall in love with a Salem tree and a rawhide quirt from Santa Cruz. I will get me a bottle of Boston Sea and a blue gum nigger to sing me blues. I am tired of loving a foreign muse. Rue de Martyrs and Bleeding Heart Yard, Senlis, Pisa, and Blindman's Oast. It is a magic ghost you guard, but I am sick for a newer ghost, Harrisburg, Spartanburg, Painted Post. Henry and John were never so, and Henry and John were always right. Granted, but when it was time to go, and the tea and the laurels had stood all night, did they never watch for Nantucket light? I shall not rest quiet in Montparnasse. I shall not lie easy in Winchelsea. You may bury my body in Sussex grass. You may bury my tongue at Champmédy. I shall not be there. I shall rise and pass. Bury my heart at Wounded Knee. Like a skein of loose silk blown against a wall, she walks by the railing of a path in Kensington Gardens, and she's dying piecemeal of a sort of emotional anemia. And round about there is a rabble of the filthy, sturdy, unkillable infants of the very poor. They shall inherit the earth. In her is the end of breeding. Her boredom is exquisite and excessive. She would like someone to speak to her, and is almost afraid that I will commit that indiscretion.
And thank you to Kirsten Powers for the poem.
BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Well, that's all for this week's The 2nd of February 2008 show, which has come to you from the Headley Radio Room by the British Empire and Commonwealth Museum in Bristol's Temple Meads Railway Station. The studio manager this week was Tony Gosling, and the reporters were Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. The presenters were Lisa Braden and myself, John Peters Coleman. We look forward to being with you again next week for Dialect's unique blend of arts and news from Bristol to Bristol and the rest of the world. Thank you to Phyllis Chichkuran for the engineering and for all the guests who came in today. So from me and the rest of the Dialect team, have a very good week. Take care.